Good morning, everyone. I'm Justin Parrish, today chairing our meeting of Community and Regional Affairs. I'm joined by my co-chair, Zach Fansler, Representative Drummond, Representative Westlake, and Representative Talrico. It is 8 a.m. on February 7th. Today, I'd like to thank our staff, Lori Rowland from House Records, Dana Owen, my committee staff, and Alex Bibi Judice, our teleconference operator. I'd like to ask all present to silence your cell phones. And in front of you, you've got an agenda with today's business. We'll first take up House Bill 80, sponsored by Representative Wool. This bill has already had a hearing in House Energy, and we have a committee substitute from them. Members should note that Community and Regional Affairs is the only other committee of referral for this bill. May I have a motion to take up House Bill 80 as our working document?
Mr. Chairman, I move we adopt HB 80 LS0337U as our working document.
Without objection, the bill is adopted. I'd like to invite the bill's sponsor and his aide to come forward and present.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Representative Adam Wolf from District 5 in Fairbanks, and I'm here to present HB 80, sometimes called PACE or CPACE, which stands for, as you see on the screen behind you or in front of you, Commercial Property Assessed Clean Energy. Would you like my full presentation of the bill? Or
it's my understanding that you've got a presentation from Sean Scaling. That's what's the PowerPoint is. But yes, please continue on the subject of the bill.
Correct.
Give us the pitch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a brief outline. AEA, Alaska Energy Authority, will make a presentation concurrent with mine. And with me, I have Rob Earl, my chief of staff, to also answer questions. Basically, the PACE bill is a funding mechanism that allows individuals that own a commercial property to get a loan for either energy efficiency or to improve the energy efficiency of a building or to improve the quality of the exhaust to make it cleaner. And then once they get this funding, they can pay it back through their assessed property tax. So it requires the borough or municipality with which the building is located to also agree to this funding mechanism.
I'd like to note that we've been joined by Representative Sadler. Please continue.
Thank you. So it allows the individual or corporation that owns the commercial property to pay back this loan, which can be stretched out over a long period of time and therefore be lower interest and lower payment, to be assessed on their property tax. So it has a very low default rate. And then if the building is sold, the loan stays with the building. So it incentivizes people to make some improvements, even if they don't plan on being at that location indefinitely. So it basically is incentivizing low-interest loans to improve energy efficiency in commercial buildings and using a borough or municipality that already has a property tax system in place as a way to pay it back. And it is entirely voluntary of the borough, so they don't have to go along with it. This just puts the mechanism in place. It's currently in place in 33 other states.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Talrico.
Just to make sure, and I have clarity so that we have it on the record, this is a voluntary program for municipalities.
This is correct. Through the chair, Representative Talrico, this is a voluntary program for the municipalities. I may add, it is supported by the AML, Alaska Municipal League, and several boroughs have sent in letters. For example, the Fairbanks North Star Borough supports it, and yes, it is entirely voluntary.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Of course. And It's my understanding that this bill has previously passed the House or some variant of this bill. Is that correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last year, this bill, in not exactly the same form, but pretty much the same form, passed the House 38-0. So there's two people not there, but everyone else voted yes, and then it didn't get through the Senate rules. But, yeah, and we added a little bit of language about the clean energy section. But other than that, yes, this bill passed 38-0.
Thank you, Representative Wohl. Seeing no other questions, I will thank you and invite Mr. Sean Scaling from the Alaska Energy Authority to come forward. I'd like to also recognize that Representative Christ Tompkins has been with us from about 8:03.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. This is Sean Scaling from Alaska Energy Authority. Happy to walk through the slides, which I presume are in front of you at this point.
And Mr. Chairman,
what I'd like to do then is just take a walk through kind of high level what commercial property assessed clean energy does and how it works. Essentially, on slide 2, you can see it's a barrier to, or it's a tool to take down a barrier for commercial property owners for financing energy improvements to their buildings. The key is it's a voluntary repayment on the property tax bill. On the next slide, I'll walk through a scenario of how this would work for a particular building, and I hope it'll illustrate just how this technique works. So in front of you is a building, happens to be one that went through Alaska Energy Authority's energy audit program in years past. And in fact, if I may, Mr. Chairman, take a moment. I think Gene Terrio is at the table and was actually interested in presenting a piece of information ahead of the slides. Mr. Terrio?
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman, Gene Terrio with ADA AEA. I'm going to advance the slides for Sean. But do have to potentially step away to another meeting. So I wanted to go over some of the content that was just going to be touched on in the very last slide. And that is to give you an indication of some of the potential funding sources that we have identified, that if the state of Alaska has this mechanism, repayment mechanism in place, it may give our municipalities and utilities better access to. A number of years ago, when I was full-time at AEA, I served on a national board of energy officials across the nation. And in that role, I started looking into programs that other states had in place and funding sources that they used for energy efficiency. And so in doing that, I came across a couple of programs, loan programs that are offered by the Rural Utility Services, which is a division of the USDA. And started investigating them. The first one that I would like to just touch on is called the Energy Efficiency Conservation Loan Program. That gets, on an annual basis, about $250 million that is available nationwide for areas of the population that are RUS eligible.
Mr. Terrio, would you mind putting your affiliation on the record as well?
Gene Terrio with ADA and AEA.
Thank you.
And in the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Loan Program, often referred to as the ECLIP program, as I indicated, there's about $250 million of funds that are available on a yearly basis. In my own discussions with RUS, they've indicated that those funds are underutilized, and they actually, as an entity, are very interested in working with states and utilities to get more of those funds deployed. In January of this year, I checked on the RUS homepage to find out exactly what the interest rate is currently. And under the ECLIP program, if you're a municipality or a utility that wants to access these funds, and you want to then loan money out to a consumer, for a 10-year period of time, the current interest rate is 2.07%. So actually relatively low cost capital that can be accessed from the RUS, funneled through a municipality or a utility, and made available to the end consumer.
We've been joined by Representative Rauscher.
And a municipality or utility that wants to access those funds then has an ability to add a little bit onto that interest rate in order to cover their administrative costs. The in the regulations for the ECLIP program, it talks about they're very interested in finding means of helping to assure that the default rates on these loans are low. And the PACE mechanism is one mechanism that helps to lower the default rate. And that's because basically the repayment is being done through an existing relationship between the borough or the city and the property owner. Every year, if that municipality has a property tax, levies a property tax, they send a bill to the commercial property owner. The commercial property owner then pays the taxes and any assessments on that property. Through a PACE mechanism, basically, what the commercial property owner is deciding to do is pay back that PACE loan through a voluntary assessment that appears on that tax bill. And the local government has all the collection powers that they have to collect their general taxes and any assessments to actually make sure that that PACE loan repayment gets made. Because of the strength of that repayment mechanism, the default rates on PACE loans nationwide is relatively low. It's less than 1%. And because of that low default rate, means it's low risk, and that is what helps you get access to the low-cost capital. In the regulations for the ECLIP program, it makes reference specifically to an on-bill repayment mechanism or other financial recoupment mechanisms as may be approved by the RUS. When AEAs began to look at what we would need to do to implement PACE in the state of Alaska, we actually corresponded with RUS, told them that we were exploring PACE, and got a letter back from the RUS basically saying that they understood the PACE mechanism, it's deployed in many other states, and the PACE mechanism would be a mechanism that they recognize would lower the rates of defaults and would be attractive to access the ECLIP funds. The second program that I would just like to touch on also is offered by the RUS. It's called the Rural Energy Savings Program. This is one that has been on the federal law books for quite a while, but that did not receive any funding until 2016. The total amount of funding that was available was about $50 million that was available nationwide. And some very attractive components of this fund is that if you are the borrowing entity, a utility or a municipality working with utility, the interest rate that comes with these funds is zero. You then get to add on up to 3% to cover your local administrative costs. But you can see if you're successful in accessing these funds and funneling them through to your end consumer, it comes with a very attractive interest rate. Within the regulations for the RESP program, it also speaks to looking for mechanisms that help to assure that the default rates on the loans are very low. And in the regulations, they also make reference to a mechanism that is often referred to as on-bill financing. But it also talks about on-bill financing, but as long as that is requirement does not prohibit the use of any additional repayment mechanism that demonstrates that has been demonstrated to have appropriate risk mitigation features. And again, a PACE mechanism is one such mechanism that helps to reduce the rates of defaults. So these are just two examples of potential sources of money. If the state of Alaska actually puts the PACE mechanism into place, it doesn't guarantee that utilities will have access to it, but these pools of money, when you look into the regulations, specifically point out that they're looking for mechanisms that help to lower the rate of default, and a PACE mechanism is one such mechanism. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it back over to Mr. Scaling to give you a little bit better idea of the way the mechanism works, but I did want to make sure that you were aware that there are some potential non-GF sources of money that we may be able to tap into if we just have some of these mechanisms in place. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Mr. Scaling, unless you've got questions.
Any questions from the committee?
Yes,
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, Mr. Terrio, you mentioned that you said when you were full-time with AEA, or what's your current status with ADA AEA?
I'm a temporary employee with ADA. Because of the sister relationship between ADA and AEA, I'm able to work back and forth on issues for both of the entities there.
And if I could ask, follow up, and your current title in the temporary capacity is?
I'm just, I think it's on the slide here, just a, whoops, I'll have to look. Energy Policy Assistant.
Thank you very much. Good deal. That's it, thanks.
I mean, a helper.
We're all helpers.
Thank you, Mr. Terrio. Mr. Scaling, if you'd please put yourself back on record with name and affiliation.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is Sean Scaling with Alaska Energy Authority. And so what I'd like to do now is look at a real-life scenario. What does this mean? So in front of you should be a slide of a commercial building. It's one that went through AEA's commercial energy audit program some years ago. The example I'll continue to give here is just a representative sample, kind of an average of what we saw at other commercial buildings. So it's not this building in particular, but that's just what's in front of you. So picture a commercial building in your community, like this one. They have high energy bills. They find it's competing or hurting their competitiveness and profitability. They're really interested in becoming more energy efficient. So they hire an energy auditor. The energy audit then shows them line by line what they can do to make the building more efficient. It might even include renewables if there's an economical one. Generally, the energy audits will show them only the things that are economical. Sometimes it might show one that's not, just for in case the building wants to go through it. But generally, what we're looking at here for PACE is energy improvements that pay for themselves over their lifetime, at least. And many of them will pay for themselves very quickly. So they get this energy audit. It shows that they could save 30% on their energy bills annually, and it's an average six-year average payback period, so relatively good payback. And of course, the improvements that they make will last for between 8 years and 20 years plus, so it's definitely a solid deal. They can save a lot of money. So they're excited to do it. They go to the bank. Well, first of all, they would have paid for it out of cash because it's a great investment in their own business, far better than the stock market and less risky. But they don't have the cash. They go to the bank, look for a bank loan. The bank looks at it, looks at all the factors that they typically would to make a loan for a commercial establishment, and offers four-year term, four-year payback with an interest rate that's maybe not as competitive as the building owners would like. Another factor facing the building owners is they've been expanding, and they're thinking about selling their building in a couple years and moving to a larger space where they can have more elbow room. And so that's also a factor in their decision. Ultimately, their decision is not to go forward with the energy improvements, even though it is a really good deal and there's a lot of improvement. And the reason is because the four-year bank term and the six-year payback period aren't in alignment with each other. This means that on day one, when they start saving 30%, they're going to be paying back their loan, which is more than the energy savings. What they'd like to do is actually start reaping some of that energy savings on day one. The other big factor is because they're moving, they're not sure if when they sell they'll get that value back from the building. Now, the building will be more appealing because of the energy improvements, but it's always a risk. You know, will the new buyer, what will the market look like? Will they recognize those savings? So they decide not to do it. They go ahead, keep paying the high rates. The building doesn't see the improvements. They do sell, the next owner comes in, and it may be years before these cost-effective improvements are implemented. So the main sticking points here are that short loan term and that they might be moving soon and they might not make their money back. So PACE addresses those two things in particular and may also impact the interest rate. On the next slide, And please just interrupt, Mr. Chairman, if there are questions. I'm at the disadvantage of being on the other end of the telephone line, but I'll listen for those as I can. So on slide four, how it works. Right up front, and it's been addressed already, this is a voluntary program, really voluntary times three. Once the state enables this PACE mechanism to be in place, munis can adopt it if they want to. If they don't want to, they don't have to. A muni that does adopt it, the commercial buildings in that community can use this tool if they want to, but they don't have to. And if they decide to use it and they go to the bank and they want to use it, the bank that holds the lien on the building already does have to approve it. And so there are a lot of protections built in, but it does allow this mechanism to help the commercial buildings that hit this barrier that we've seen so often. It will really help them get through. In fact, I'll elaborate on that really often. 79% of the respondents that went through the commercial energy audit program several years ago said that the main reason that they didn't move forward with the improvements was lack of access to financing. There were about 180 commercial energy audits conducted. Quite a bit of work did come out of it, but that was the main obstacle to not moving forward on larger chunks. So to me, the main crux here is that the banks than any other lending institution is now more comfortable with the energy savings because there is a structure in place. A real energy audit will be conducted. There will be real energy savings. So there's less risk, which helps the bank spread out the terms to a longer period of time so that folks, the commercial building owners can take advantage of it. Also, because you're paying it back on your voluntarily on your tax assessment, the payment sticks with the building. So if you do move out of the building, the benefits that you've built into the building stay with the building, and the payments for those stay in the building. So in this scenario, if they stayed for 3 years out of a six-year payback, let's say the bank gave them a seven-year term, by the time they sold, they'd be, you know, halfway sold, paid up on their loan. The new building owners would come in. It would be appealing because the efficiency measures would be in place. And they would only have, four more years of payment, and then it's all savings.
In just a moment. We have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Scaling, a quick question. We spoke of the auditors. I'm curious to find out if there's any qualifications or standards for the people who would do audits to achieve the program envisioned by this bill.
Through the chair, Mr. Representative Sadler, yes, typically there are standards applied. Alaska has used energy raters at different levels. For the commercial buildings, we typically specify ASHRAE Level 2, which comes with a set of requirements that go with it. So there are existing levels that the state has used that have worked well in the past.
If you could spell out the acronym and elaborate a little bit, I'm not sure.
To the chair, certainly. You're going to test my abilities here. ASHRAE, A-S-H-R-A-E, American Society of Heating, Air Conditioning, A-S-H-R-A-E, and I'm sorry, I may be missing a few of them, but it's basically the Association of Heating, Air Conditioning, and whatnot, I believe. And I can double-check on that because I'd like to get that correct.
Follow up? Thank you. Mr. Scaling, just through the chair, how many ASHRAE qualified people are there in Alaska? Is there an ample supply of folks to accomplish this? Do you have any idea what the supply of those people are?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the timing is actually great because we've done a fair amount of work both on the residential energy efficiency improvements and in commercial buildings in recent years, and now we're finding that work is dwindling. So we actually have a pool of qualified folks out there who are having a difficult time finding work, I believe. So this would actually be a nice a little bit of work that could crop out of it for the folks who are already qualified.
And a follow-up? And so it sounds like, in your estimation, Mr. Scaling, that there's enough people. Any idea the number of such folks?
Through the chair, I am not exactly sure. My guess would be on the order of 5 to 10.
And that's for the entire state, through the chair?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Please proceed, Mr. Skilling.
So on slide 5, talks about some of the improvements. There are both energy efficiency and alternative energy improvements. So efficiency is listed here. It's some of the things I had mentioned before: heating, air conditioning, lights, pumps, controls, anything that will end up saving money, and typically modernizing buildings to more current standards. We at AEA have found that energy efficiency improvements are some of the lowest hanging fruit and some of the most available improvements that can be made. And so there's a lot of opportunity within energy efficiency. And that is both on the heating side and the electric side. On the next slide, just list a few of the alternative energy improvements that could be made. Probably the most common we may see is air pumps from ground, water, or air source heat pumps. Solar is a possibility. It would have to be economical, though. Biomass, basically wood heat for commercial buildings could be a possibility. Fuel switching that could improve efficiency and air quality is another example. So those are the main improvements that we would be seeing through this. On the next slide shows that cash flow that I was talking about earlier. The green is...
Just a moment, Mr. Skilling. Representative Fensler?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, also included wind and any other winterization projects or things like that for eligible improvements?
Through the chair, Representative Fensler, yes. Well, I'll say yes and no. Certainly on the weatherization side, that's a lot of the energy efficiency work I've talked about, so it could be air sealing, additional insulation, windows, doors, seals, all that is definitely included and very typical in small commercial buildings. Wind could be eligible. However, it's not our experience that wind on a building scale, which would have to be attached to the building, would be economical. You typically want to have a larger scale wind and in a windy place, not necessarily just wherever the building is situated. So it's conceivable, although highly, highly unlikely, I would say, because of the economics.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, Mr. Skilling, on slide 6, you mentioned fuel switching. Could this be one way that folks in the interior, for example, might be able to switch from heating oil to natural gas as a fuel source?
Through the chair, yes, that is correct, particularly where there's either air quality improvements or cost savings or reduction in fuel use. Any of those are written into the bill as potentially qualifying.
Follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, actually, I've got some questions. The bill has language saying that projected emissions reductions. I'm curious to find out who would do that projection and what they might base that on.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sadler, the energy auditor typically will line out each individual action that they could see the building taking. So it should include the cost of the measure, the dollar savings, the energy savings, and in this case it could include even the air emission savings, which typically is not difficult to add once you know the fuel savings.
Okay. And a follow-up on the same topic. I think on page 9, there's also one of the criteria, operating as intended, and I could butt back to the bill language. Does that include achieving the projected emission reduction?
Through the chair, I believe that is the intent of that language, to make sure that measures are installed and actually achieving what is intended by the initial energy audit that recommended them.
Okay.
Thanks. Good.
Please proceed, Mr. Skilling.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. On slide 7 shows the cash flow from the energy improvements. So the green is the area that is the cost of the building owner, both electric and heat. You can see at a certain point in time, there's a significant drop in that. That's where the energy efficiency and other improvements were made. And that's representing about the 30% decline that we see On average, with these commercial energy audits, so there is a lot of savings potential. So they're saving a lot of money, and now since this loan has PACE legislation, the financial institutions are able to offer a longer loan repayment period, such that the loan repayment is less than the energy cost savings. So there's cash flow positive. The building owner is cash flow positive from day one when the energy efficiency improvements are made. So that really is one of the keys to this legislation.
Just a moment. We have a question from Representative Rauscher. We have also been joined by Representative Johnson. Welcome. Representative Rauscher, if you please.
Yes, through the chair. Is the intent of the energy auditor to help design or to just approve the type of energy to be used in conjunction with the savings, if you understand what I'm trying to say? Are they to make sure that the savings will be achieved by what the process that the borrower wants to utilize in their building? How does that work, I guess?
To the chair, Representative Rauscher, typically an energy audit will specify the type of equipment to go in. So what I often see is it'll say replace electric water heater with air source heat pump water heater such as, and it'll specify a type and an efficiency level. And so it'll give the building owner one option. Typically I'll see one or two options of something that's specified by the auditor, but it's the building owner ultimately will try to match that, or will match that by in some cases the auditor is not going to tell them specifically you must have this type of equipment, but rather specify one and perhaps a range of savings that could be achieved. So a new boiler such as blah blah, or achieving 93% efficiency or higher or something like that. If the building owner were to install something that was less efficient, then the subsequent follow-up energy audit should be able to catch that and identify the current cost savings. I suspect that a lot of this enabling language doesn't get to that level exactly. A lot of this, munis will be able to initiate their own programs, and this sets the guidelines and the process so that an energy audit does have to happen. And then ultimately, just like today, any of these commercial buildings will be going to the banks and seeking a loan. It's a matter of what the bank is comfortable with. So probably that's where the rubber hits the road of specifying and knowing what is going to be going in at that time.
Follow up?
Yeah, I understand it. I apologize, but I was just trying to understand how they actually achieve their 30%. So make sure that everybody is, the loan is worth their time, the program is worth what we're trying to accomplish here, and I appreciate your comments. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
If I could, thank you, Mr. Chair. Might be an appropriate time to ask Mr. Scaling, again, the property owner himself or herself is responsible for paying for the audit. That's correct? There's no provision to fold in the cost of that audit into the financing, unless I'm misunderstanding.
Through the chair, the financing may be actually covered within the loan. Any of the fees associated with doing this work may be folded into that loan.
Okay. So they can finance it. Great. Thank you.
Please proceed.
Slide 8 is a diagram that shows how the loan is repaid. Let's start the property owner in the middle. The property owner, as we discussed, has some energy improvements they'd like to do. They go to the investors in the bottom right corner, which could be a bank. It could be any sort of financial institution or perhaps even the local government if they have funding to offer. The property owner then pays back those loans through an assessment on a voluntary assessment on their property tax. And so that goes from the property owner to the city or local government, which then would pay back the investor that money. So that's what offers the investors, the banks, additional security in this, knowing that it will be, that their payments will be made and that the default rates will be very low and lower than typical. On slide 9, just shows that 33 states have enabled PACE legislation. This has been a fairly rapid development. Last year's slides, quite a few slides have been added since we've made similar presentations last year. This program in Alaska has been modeled after Texas's legislation, which has been very popular. They now have about a dozen communities within Texas that are running with PACE programs now, so it's been a rapid acceleration in use of the program in Texas.
Representative Rauscher?
Yes, through the chair, thank you. Is there some success statistics out there or adverse?
Through the chair, I heard the question as, are there successful statistics, are there perhaps failures? Is that what the question is?
Yeah, just nationwide, you've got a lot of programs in different states you've marked on the map here. I was just wondering, is there a success rate, statistics out there, or some other, you know, maybe some failures, or what are the nationwide statistics on this program?
Through the chair, there are some good statistics. The main one that I'm familiar with is the default rate of less than 1%, which I think is probably the one of the greatest successes of the program overall. There are others. I don't know them off the top of my head. Perhaps Mr. Terrio does.
Mr. Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, I know that organizations like PACE Nation, which is a national group that monitors the different programs in states, have examples, you know, specific examples of buildings and the savings that were achieved. As Mr. Scaling indicated, the default rate across the nation is low, specifically for the commercial PACE programs. Commercial PACE didn't start until 2008. In many states, it didn't really start to gather momentum until the last 4 or 5 years. So, you know, that information on the success rate or where there have been problems is not real deep. But again, that the fact that the default rates are really low, we think is an indication that by and large the program operates as intended.
Thank you, Mr. Terrio. Representative Rauscher?
Yeah, through the chair, one follow-up question. Well, then, how about, is there anything out there on whether or not 30% or close to 30% or more like 10% was actually achieved as opposed to the actual, you know, and that's what I guess mean by success, you know, was the realization there for the loaners, you know what I'm saying? Is there anything out there on that, whether they, you know, some of them came up short, some of them maybe only one, maybe nobody came up short to their expectations?
Through the chairman, this is Sean Scaling. To address that question, Representative Rauscher, the success rate we've seen on energy efficiency measures in public buildings across the state and even residential buildings and commercial buildings, they all tend to gravitate toward that 30% savings. So if you implement the cost-effective measures, that's what you see, and not only on the front end but on the back end as well, meaning after there you have been achieved, the measured success, the measured savings does hit the targets at about 30% on average is what we're seeing.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Slide 10, this is just saying it's time to add Alaska to that map. There's no cost to the state. It's simply enabling legislation, and I think really importantly, it's voluntary. On slide 11, this really is a win for users all around. So property owners, for example, will pay lower utility bills. Their property is improved. They have a better work environment, which studies have shown shows to better productivity among employees and can help with their profitability and competitiveness. Lenders are making new loans. There's less risk. It's a consistent process statewide. Contractors and vendors are busier. They are being hired to make these improvements. More local hiring. those contractors are keeping up with best practices and new technology advancements in energy and energy efficiency. And then even tenants benefit, communities benefit, the local air quality can benefit. There really are benefits all around, and we're seeing no downside to this program and process. And on the last slide, this is just an easy win for Alaska. As was mentioned before, it passed the House 38, basically to 2, and I think I heard a sound. Third question. No, I'll continue. So it's gotten strong support all around from all the users or potentially impacted user groups. It is completely voluntary, and I see this as a small economic driver. Rather than spending money on fuel that leaves the community, whether that's fuel for electricity or fuel for heating the building, money spent on fuel quickly leaves the community as opposed to hiring folks locally to then save money in the long term, and that money from that business can be circulating in the community for much longer. And with that, Mr. Chairman, it concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to take further questions.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Scaling, just if you would revisit the cash flow, capital flow on slide 8, looking at the block in the lower right-hand corner labeled investors, is that ECLA and RESP, or does ECLA and RESP provide money into the investors? I just want to make sure I properly understand the flow of money.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, the ECLIP and RESP programs would provide the capital to typically a local or a city or local government for them to loan out, to reloan as a pool. I guess it's probably conceivable that investors could use that too. It would depend on the rules of the program, but I think that money would typically go to a, it would have to go to an eligible borrower, which would, which I don't think would be a commercial lending institution, for example.
Fair enough. Follow up. So, so basically, ECLA and RESP would be considered the investors in that block. So I can consider. So you're saying they would provide funding to the city or local government should there not be a? Well, I guess they. I just want to make sure that there's not should not be a line from investors into city or local government.
Representative Sadler, that is another option that could be exercised, is the city or local government could amass their own pool of money through bonding or through this federal source, and then the representative, the relationship is essentially between the property owner and the city. So the city is both lending the money and receiving it, and it's coming back on the tax bills. I think and then the other option is with these investors would be any sort of a financial institution that's separate from the muni. Typically, or a muni may also use an investor or some sort of financial institution to manage that cash. These are all things that the city and investors could figure out as the money pool became available.
Okay, thank you.
Unless Representative Rusher.
Yeah, through the chair, I think maybe Mr. Terrio, what's a home in the municipality?
Basically, one that has the power to establish their own rules. Basically, they've got full power to, through passage of ordinance, set up the rules. They don't default to just powers that are enumerated in the statute. They're given basically kind of like a legislative power to establish their own rules.
Is that like a second-class borough or something?
Well, in the front part of the bill here, I think we're giving this power to home rule boroughs, first and second class. But I think you've got some former municipal officials that can pop up on your panel that could answer that question perhaps with more detail.
Representative Tallarico.
Thank you. A home rule borough can do anything that isn't prohibited by law and Alaska statutes.
Excellent.
Yes, for sure.
Further questions for our presenters?
No, thank you.
Well, Representative Westlake.
Yes, through the chair, if I may make a comment here.
Please.
Mr. Scaling and Mr. Therio, I see this and the implications on here, and my private life, my private practice that we do. Energy is a good, you know, something that we work on. And I've got to commend you. After reading through this, I mean, the implications for at least one municipality are good, and the implications for the state are even better should this come through. So thank you very much for this presentation.
Thank you. Unless there are any further questions, we will dismiss both of you and invite public testimony. At present, it looks like we have Brittany Smart online. So let's, oops. Brittany, are you there? Well.
Good morning, Chair. Brittany Smart with Mayor Castle office at the Fairbanks North Star Borough. We wanted to provide our supportive testimony on HB 80. While we understand that this financing measure can also be used for commercial entities to weatherize and provide energy efficiencies for their facilities, we are most interested in the implications that this could play on natural gas conversions and improving our air quality. For all those reasons, we support this this bill and look for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smart. Are there, oh, would you please put your affiliation, you did put your affiliation on record, didn't you? Thank you.
I did, Brittany Smart, Mayor of Fairbanks North Star Borough, Mayor Castle's office.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Smart? Well then, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will close public testimony. And I'd be willing to entertain a motion to move this bill out of committee.
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease.
First, we need a motion, and then.
Well, once we have a motion, then we only can have one discussion time. Brief at ease.
Brief at ease. I believe we have some further discussion on the bill. Representative Tallarico.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I gave about as brief a description about home rule municipalities as I possibly could, but. Title 29, of course, has established that all the municipalities are subdivisions of the state of Alaska, and there are particular classifications and rules, which I'm sure everyone's somewhat familiar with. And home rule actually establishes its complete charter and structures all of its rules. And like I say, anything that is not prohibited by state statute is allowed in home rule. As to where a first class borough has particular programs that are listed in Title 29. Which I think we're trying to add to the programs here within Title 29. That's what this amendment would do for both first-class and second-class boroughs. And so I think really what this does is just adds a tool to the toolbox for both those first-class and second-class boroughs. And I may be mistaken when it mentions home rule in there, but I think since they already have taxing authority and platting authority and all of those typical things, they also would have the ability to participate in these programs. I'm not an expert, but I was a home rule mayor for 10 years, so I'm more familiar with that than first class and second class.
Very much like an expert. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. On a different topic, we've got a question on page 10 of the bill, section, actually starting off with line 7 through 13. I just want to ask the sponsor or anybody who can speak for him about this. I just want to clarify that I understand the goal of making sure a municipality cannot hold somebody hostage by not issuing a permit, license, or other authorization if they have not chosen to take part in this process. But the way the language is constructed, it sounds like it's making a specific reference to a person entering a written contract. So I want to clarify this for the record that this section laid out in 7 through 14 is just making it clear that a municipality cannot make issuance of any permit contingent on a person participating in the program. It's not just the written contract aspect, it's participating in the PACE program at all. I just want to get that clear. Is that correct?
Representative Wool, if you'd return and put yourself on record. Your assistant is, of course, also welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Representative Wool addressing the question through the chair to Representative Sadler. I read this section, lines 7 through 13.
Yeah.
It sounds like they can't sort of hold it over somebody to that the contingent on the person entering a written contract, correct, to repay the financing. The person can't be compelled to enter a contract, yeah.
That's what I'm looking for, yeah. It's not as if, through the chair, it's not as if someone can participate in this without a contract, and certainly they wouldn't be allowed to obtain financing without putting their signature on a contract.
Correct,
I did just, the way it was written made me just want to clarify that it's not written versus unwritten. It's just they want to make sure that someone cannot be held hostage by the municipality for any permit or authorization to which they might otherwise be qualified if they decided not to take part in this project.
It's voluntary on both ends.
Thank you, that's what I'm looking for. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion to pass the bill out of committee.
Mr. Chair, I move to pass HB 80 version LS0377U, 337U from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Seeing no objections, the bill is passed out of committee. We'll take a brief at ease to collect signatures and individual recommendations. The committee will return to order. As a point of information, the previous bill, House Bill 80, had an attached zero fiscal note. Next on the agenda, we have House Bill 85, sponsored by Representative Christ Tompkins. May I have a motion to take up House Bill 85?
So moved.
I think we've got to say it in the long form.
I move that we take up House Bill 85 for discussion.
Need to say LS0384.
Oh, do I need to say it that way?
Brief it is. Seeing no objection. We have taken up House Bill 85. I would like to invite the bill's sponsor, Representative Christ Tompkins, to come forward and to present his statement.
Thank you. And Mr. Co-Chair, if it would be all right, I would invite Ms. Barrett Wilbur, staff in our office, to join at the presenter's table, if that's all right with you.
Quite all right. Please come forward.
I can give the higher elevation overview of this piece of legislation and then perhaps pass the baton to Barrett. But House Bill 85 is companion legislation to identical legislation in the other body that is currently on its legislative journey. And this relates to the new formation of the Petersburg Borough, which creating municipal government and local government that is self-sufficient and non-reliant on state services, of course, a standing goal of the legislature. And as a part of that borough creation process, the Petersburg Borough is entitled to a land selection. And because of sort of idiosyncrasies with the land base from which the Petersburg Borough is allowed to select, there's a pretty minimal amount of acreage that is available for selection per the formula might be the best way to describe it. And so This piece of legislation sort of recalibrates the acreage that Petersburg Borough is able to select to the historic norm that newly formed boroughs in the past in Alaska have been able to select. This is a process with which the Representative Tallarico is very familiar. We had a good conversation about this yesterday and actually learned quite a bit, which we will be sure to pass on to the Petersburg folks, about the process and the actual process selection. This is all to say we want to sort of bring the Petersburg Borough into the historic norms of land selection, and this bill is what does it. And I'll defer to Barrett for further explanation for any high-level points I might have missed.
Good morning. My name is Barrett Wilbur, staff to Rep. Christ Tompkins. Through the chair, I think the representative pretty much covered it. I'll just maybe cite a few numbers that he could have also cited. Sorry. So, yeah, the typical process is for a new borough, 10% of vacant, unappropriated, unreserved land is allowed for the borough to select as part of their new land area. In the matter in Petersburg, of course, 96% of the total land area of the borough belongs to the Tongass National Forest. And then there's other kind of conveyances of land within that remaining 4%, which don't allow, it means the proportion of unreserved land in the Petersburg borough, of vacant land in the Petersburg borough, is extremely small. And so the percentage that they end up qualifying for under the typical formula is just, it's like 1,300 acres and isn't enough to support kind of the needs and resources that a new borough needs to be able to be successful. So traditionally, or at least 14 times since 1990, new boroughs have gone through this process of kind of specifically editing land entitlement grants through statute, and that's what Petersburg is in the process of doing now. So, thanks.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair, to the sponsor. Would you lay out for the record the specific formula and statute for the award of land to a newly formed borough?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I'll defer to Barrett Wilbur or folks at DNR as to the specifics of the formula, with which I'm unfamiliar. I mean, besides the broader sort of percentage terms that Barrett described, I'm actually not sure of the specific mechanics of the formula. And I should realize, I think I may have omitted my identification affiliation. My name is John and Grace Tompkins, and I represent rural Southeast Alaskan District 35. I should put that on the record.
I'm sorry, my name is Barrett Wilbur, staff to Rep. Christ Tompkins. I think I could give an answer to that, but if there's someone on the line from DNR, I'd prefer to defer to them.
We have Marty Parsons from the Department of Natural Resources online in Anchorage. Marty, would you be willing to answer this question?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Of course I will. This is Marty Parsons. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water here in Anchorage. This particular statute that you're looking for is AS 2965-030, and it establishes the 10% of the vacant, unappropriated, unreserved land to be available to a newly formed municipality or borough to select and create their land entitlement.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons, through the chair. And through the chair to the sponsor, I've heard you say the historic norms, and I think I heard your staffer say traditionally. I'm just curious if that standard exists anywhere in statute or anyplace else, or if that's just kind of a post facto construction.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, good question about whether we're talking about post facto constructions. My understanding is that there have been past pieces of legislation. In Southeast Alaska, I'm more familiar with legislation from former Representative Peggy Wilson of Wrangell, with the Wrangell land selection that I believe sort of calibrated the percentage of land that the borough or municipal government is able to select to the 0.7, 0.8. Percent of all land encompassed within the borough. area anomalies outside that range, I'm unaware of. The information I've been presented with is that this is considered the norm, and it's sort of been the goal in order to incent the formation of local governments and boroughs to have a land selection in that area to create a base for economic development, for community uses, local control, all of that, and that if we sort of allow these highly, forgive the oxymoron, but these de minimis land selections that sort of offered a very small amount of acreage for the creation of boroughs, that you may be taking away, so to speak, an incentive for these local governments to create, because they wouldn't have a land base from which to work and offer the local control that helps them function.
Follow up? Thank you for the answer. And I appreciate that if in the absence of a statute or clearly delineated policy in the legislature, you kind of go by past practice. But if the past 14 formed municipalities or boroughs have found it necessary to get an additional land selection, did you consider ever changing the formula to avoid the problem of having the formulaic allocation of land be de minimis?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that's an excellent question. Honestly, hadn't seriously considered it, although I agree. I generally do find a lot of appeal in changing a system to kind of make it more functional and self-sustaining rather than continuing to sort of pursue stopgap solutions. And I think of license plates as an example of that. And actually, there's another bill that I think was sailing through here last year or this year that reminded me, in which there's sort of a series of stopgap solutions. I'm at the same time sort of cautious about. I wonder if that could be pursued in parallel. And I sort of do want to see, given the creation of the Petersburg Borough, that we're, or at least I'm sort of doing my best effort to accelerate this along with legislation in the other body. But I don't think in any way that should be exclusive to perhaps looking at maybe a more holistic solution. And I wonder if Representative Tallarico, given his background or others, I would love to confer with members of this committee or other members of our body, maybe to look at a solution to that.
Through the chair, I can see the request of the new Nikiski borough that's in the works, and there's other things. So it might be nice to fix the whole thing, I understand. So, and I think I'll top you regarding license plates. That would be a productio ad absurdum issue. So, and we'll stop with the Latin right now, shall we?
Representative Rocher.
I'm good. Thank you.
All right. Any further questions for the bill's sponsor?
Actually, Representative Sadler? Mr. Chair, Co-Chair, I would ask this is a discussion I have with one of your representatives from your community development people. What would the borough of Petersburg propose to do with the additional land, and why would the amount of land envisioned in this bill provide enough resources? What would the Petersburg borough do with the land that would help support the economy and all the other aims?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I might defer to representatives from the Petersburg borough, and I don't want to put words in their mouth and get it wrong. I am sort of familiar with the thinking direction of Petersburg government, and I read the minutes of their meetings and read the weekly summaries of the assembly meetings. I think there's a keen interest in Petersburg and developing value-added industry with seafood and marine services sector. There's like a lot of southeastern communities, a high cost of living, partly because of a limited land base, and it makes it hard to develop new land and new housing. And that's something that's true in Petersburg as well as Sitka and Juneau, all of these communities that are surrounded by federal land, basically, and hemmed in. So, just a few thoughts that I think are probably in the mark, but I think for a more specific answer would defer the Petersburg Borough to for greater accuracy.
Any further questions for the bill's sponsor? Representative Rauscher.
Yes, through the chair. Representative, this went through the Boundary Commission, right?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, the formation of the Petersburg Borough, I believe, did go through the Local Boundary Commission.
Okay. Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, we will move on to public testimony. Thank you both. On the line, we have the mayor of Petersburg, Mr. Mark Jensen.
Good morning. Thank you. This is Mayor Mark Jensen from Petersburg. Thank you, Representative Parrish and community members, for this opportunity to testify on the House Bill 85. We have passed a resolution in Petersburg. The Assembly has. It's Resolution 2017-02. I believe that is in your information packet this morning. And that is a resolution in support of House Bill 85 and Senate Bill 28. Also with you in the audience today is to testify from Petersburg is Liz Cabrera. She's our Director of Community and Economic Development. She can answer any particular questions probably with more accuracy than I could. But yes, we did go through the Local Boundary Commission process and a vote of the residents within the entire borough to form a borough back in 2013. And we are asking for your support on this House Bill 85 to acquire these extra acres, which would give us up to 14,666 total acres within our borough boundary. So with that being said, if you don't have any questions, I would appreciate your support for this bill. Thank you.
Hey, it looks like we do have some questions for you. Representative Rauscher. I'm sorry, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know we all look alike. But it's really, Mayor Jensen, I want to ask you through the chair, kind of a policy, kind of political question. I understand from Liz that about 96% of the land encompassed by the borough boundaries is national forest. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, yes, that is correct. So that's because of the borough being within the Tongass National Forest.
And follow up, that's kind of the story of Southeast Alaska writ large, that the large existence of this national forest does place a cap on private development. So to further push the point, if there were a little bit less national forest in your borough areas, would that open up land for development that could benefit the people of the Petersburg region?
I would imagine so if it was if it became available for us to request land from within it. Yes, that would surely help the municipalities within the Tongass National Forest to acquire more land.
Thank you.
Are there any further questions for Mayor Jensen? Seeing none, thank you for your time, Mr. Jensen.
Thank you for your time.
Next up, I would like to invite Ms. Cabrera to come forward. If you'd please put your name and affiliation on the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Liz Cabrera. I'm the Community Development Director for the Petersburg Borough. And I want to thank you and the committee members for the opportunity to speak to you today about HB 85, an act related to the general land entitlement of the Petersburg Borough. HB 85 sets the general land entitlement of Alaska's newest borough, Petersburg, to be comparable to the land entitlement received by all the other boroughs in the state, an amount equal to approximately 0.79% of a borough's land mass, which in Petersburg's case is 14,666 acres. For those of you who are unfamiliar with our community, the Petersburg Borough is located in central southeast Alaska and encompasses an area of 3,800 square miles of land and sea. The borough's population center is located on the northern tip of Mitkoff Island, which is home to a diverse and prolific commercial fishing fleet and three major seafood processing facilities. In 2013, the residents of Petersburg voted to form a borough for a number of reasons, including having a greater say on land use decisions in our surrounding area, having an opportunity to increase our municipal land base. And many also felt it was very important for all area residents to support our school system, a system that we are extremely proud of in our community, and support it through local taxes. About 12 months after borough formation, the Petersburg received a general land grant entitlement certification from the state, indicating we were entitled to 1,896 acres under Alaska statute. However, this amount was reduced by 457 acres that we'd already received when we were formed as a city of Petersburg, even though certain tracts of the city's 457 acres are actually restricted from development and only available for public, charitable, or recreational use. So after deducting the 457 acres, the borough's land entitlement was set at 1,438 acres. And to put that into some context, that's about a third the size of the Anchorage International Airport. In making this calculation, DNR uses a statutory formula. A municipality is entitled to 10% of VUU land within its boundaries. The lands available for selection are designated as VUU, or vacant, unappropriated, and unreserved land by the state of Alaska. These lands are either unclassified or classified as agricultural, grazing, materials, public recreation, settlement, and resource management. But for the most part, no development has occurred on any of the VUU lands. You may wonder why we received such a small land entitlement to begin with. The majority of land within the borough, over 96%, is managed by the federal government as the Tongass National Forest. Of the non-federal lands within the borough, 1.73% is owned by the Gold Belt Corporation, 1.34% by the state of Alaska, 0.4% by the Alaska Mental Health Trust and University of Alaska, only 0.3% is in private ownership, and a mere 0.04% is owned by the municipality. When DNR applied the land entitlement formula to the Petersburg borough, only a small amount of land remained in VUU status. As we began to evaluate our potential selection, we realized that our entitlement wasn't adequate for what we were hoping to accomplish, and that many other boroughs had received their land entitlements through the legislative process. You'll note in HB 85 that Petersburg is actually the 16th borough to receive a land entitlement through the legislature. So 15 boroughs out of 18 boroughs in existence have already received their entitlement through the legislature. The most recent example was in 2010, when both Wrangell and Haynes received additional acreage. So why is this important to Petersburg specifically? As I mentioned previously, just over 96% of our land base is federally managed. And of our non-federal land, the major landholders are Gold Belt Corporation and the state of Alaska. In short, while the borough itself is relatively large, the majority of land is not and will never be included in the local tax base, and most is not available to generate economic return to our residents or to the state of Alaska. The Petersburg Borough would like the opportunity to move some of these lands into private ownership and add them into our tax base as residential or commercial developments. We would like the opportunity to secure new sources of rock for construction and maintenance of our roads and other projects. And we'd like the opportunity to use some of our land to address the requirements of the Army Corps of Engineers compensatory mitigation rule, which affects nearly every new development project within the borough. We'd like to do that by establishing a community wetlands mitigation bank. This would directly benefit residents by expediting the process of obtaining a wetlands permit for new development projects. Almost everything within the Petersburg borough is considered wetlands, so even projects as small as a single-family residence are required to fulfill the wetlands mitigation rule. 1,400 acres simply does not provide sufficient developable land to support these goals. In our discussions with the Department of Natural Resources, they explained that the agency generally does not voice support for this type of legislation, but neither does the agency oppose Petersburg's request. We provided a general outline of the lands we would select under HB 85, and DNR did not express any concerns about these potential selections. Lastly, the members of this committee know better than most that these are difficult times for the state of Alaska. In our own small way, we in Petersburg want to be part of the solution and not a casualty of the crisis. An increased land base is a key component to the long-term sustainability of our municipality. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cabrera, could you give us, the committee, some better information about what are the characteristics of the land that you would hope to get? And again, the same question I asked earlier of the sponsor, how would you find that land to be put into private development and benefit the people of the region?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, DNR provided us with maps, so they've already decided for us what the pool of selectable land is. And that ranges from Muskeg in the middle of an island, which with no road access and no utilities, to the top of a mountain, to some okay waterfront property. So it's really scattered all throughout the borough. So there's really no, it's not a contiguous piece. We had a ad hoc land selection committee put together. It included residents. Some of them were licensed surveyors and had done a lot of work throughout the borough. And we just sat down and started prioritizing using a criteria we had established which lands would best fit with each criteria and what our priorities were. And some land is suitable for settlement. There's probably some good remote, what I would call waterfront amenity land, that could potentially be moved into private hands. There's also land that has established rock quarries on it, and I keep bringing that up, but it's really important to us. The rock quarry that we have is, we're kind of at the end of the good rock in the rock quarry, and so we really need to find an alternative. Just about everything we do, we put down a rock pad and build up from there, so it's really important to us. And then the things that the land that really we looked at that wasn't really developable, it wasn't really good for that, we're trying to identify where we might have an entire watershed so that we could create that wetlands mitigation bank. But that is hopefully land that we really have no other use for, you know, and so, and there's certainly plenty of that in our selection. So as long as we can find a large enough piece that satisfies the core, we'd like to move forward with that too. Did I answer your question?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Representative Westlake.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, we're hearing that the 14,666 acres that you won from the state, and if you can't answer this here, just feel free to pass it to DNR, because one of the things, as I'm listening, it's 96% is fed lands. Believe me, I can sympathize with you. With that, how much acreage does the state have down there for granting your wish, and how, basically, for Alaskans, I mean, we absolutely believe in home rule, the people creating their own destinies, if you will. But is there any, by everything said and done, or will we have land down there in the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Westlake, at first I thought you were going to offer us more, but but do that as it may. The state, I don't know the entire amount that the state has. What I do know is the amount they have in VU status, which is 18,000 acres. So that leaves out a large acreage in the center of our kind of our population area, which is the airport. It leaves out any kind of developed facilities that they have. So all of the things that the state has used for a state function have already been developed and set aside. And so all we're looking at is a portion of that land that they haven't used anything for. So I don't actually, I can get the numbers to you specifically, but I don't have those on hand.
Thank you.
Representative Tallarico.
Thank you for being here today. If I described this community as having a real desire and drive to be self-sufficient, is that a fair assessment?
Through the chair. Yes, it is.
Okay. And thank you. A very admirable quality for a municipality to be self-sufficient.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, then.
Thank you.
Representative Satter.
I didn't mean to interrupt the public testimony. I came up with a question for Mr. Parsons of DNR. But I don't want to interrupt testimony, pardon me.
All right. Is there anyone in the room wishing to testify? And no one else online? So we will close public testimony. And now we'll move on to questions for DNR. Mr. Parsons, are you still on the line?
Yes, Representative, I am, and prepared to answer questions.
Thank you. Excellent.
Mr. Sheriff, this is Representative Sadler through the chair to Mr. Parsons. The question I want, we apparently have a system in which the formula under statute does not give sufficient land to local boroughs to do what they want to do with their land. And so we have an ad hoc selection process by modifying AS 2965030. My question is this: what percentage of the vacant, unappropriated, unrestricted land use, after all the adjustments were made, what have we come up with about what percentage of the VUU land do boroughs actually have now? Obviously with an eye towards looking at possibly modifying the formula to reflect the end state.
Representative Sadler, through the chair, if we go back and look at 2965010, it provides us with a list of communities, boroughs in the state that have received entitlement. An important thing to remember is that 12 of those are under 010 as part of the historic memorialization of previous pre-1978 land selections, and those were approximately 10% of the VUU land within the borough. We do have one borough, the Aleutians East, I believe, that actually reduced their entitlement because it was so large, because of the amount of VUU land didn't feel comfortable trying to manage that much. Recently, there were two boroughs, City and Borough of Wrangell and City of Borough of Haines, that requested additional entitlement above and beyond the 10% of VUU land, which was handled a couple of years ago through the legislative process. But primarily, the amount is calculated under 030, which is 10% of the VUU land within the borough. Does that answer your question, Representative?
I think so. Through the chair, I kind of want to feedback and make sure. So you're saying that of the boroughs that reflect historical boundaries, they actually have about 10% of the VUU land, and Wrangell and Haines boroughs, city and boroughs, requested more, and now we have Petersburg borough requesting a little bit more. So I think what I hear you saying is 10% is about the historical average. Is that correct?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that is correct. That's the calculation of the VUU land, state-owned land within the borough, regardless of how many acres are contained within the boundaries of the borough. It's only those state lands that are considered VUU that are used in the calculation.
Thank you. And one more
follow-up.
So it sounds like Petersburg is a special case because of the preponderance of land that's locked up in the Tongass National Forest. Is that fair?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, just for a couple of percentages, when we looked at Haines and looked at Wrangell, Haines received an additional amount to bring theirs to 21% of the VUU land within their borough, and through negotiations with Wrangell, theirs was 44.2% of the VUU land within their borough, and the Wrangell borough also contains a fairly large percentage of the Tongass National Forest.
Darn that Tongass. Okay, thanks.
Representative Rusher.
Now, through the chair, will this open up for past municipalities to ask for a little more?
Oh,
I guess this would be for the DNR.
Yes, for Mr. Parsons.
Yep.
In your estimation, will this open the door for past municipalities who have already been granted land allotments to ask for more?
Mr. Chairman, through
Representative Rauscher, I'm sorry.
I can't say what the other boroughs would do. I know from a historical standpoint, when Wrangell asked for additional entitlement, Haines came along and requested that their entitlement be expanded as part of that same piece of legislation. It would not be outside the realm of possibility that other boroughs would decide that they would like to increase their entitlement through this process.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Parsons? And Representative Rauscher, if you'd like, we could invite the bill's sponsor back forward to address your question.
Sure.
Representative Christ-Tompkins, if you wouldn't mind returning and putting yourself back on record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Jonathan Christ-Tompkins, Representative of District 35. Mm-hmm. I think perhaps to some extent history and precedent might inform the answer to your question, Representative Rauscher, through the chair. I think when, to my knowledge, in the past when boroughs are formed, they get their allotment, they try to sort of take care of it then and there, and I am not aware of, and Mr. Parsons can correct me if I'm wrong, of previously formed boroughs coming back many, many years after the fact and saying, give me more. Petersburg Borough just formed, so this is sort of all part of the borough creation process. For instance, I see it as unlikely that the Denali Borough, for instance, is going to see this bill, given that the Denali Borough, for instance, or name your borough in Alaska, had a sort of similar proportion of land it was granted in its creation process, would want more because in proportional terms it's all quite equitable.
Representative Tallarico?
Mr. Chairman, if I could have the liberty to add to Representative Christ-Tompkins.
You do.
A good example would be the Denali Borough with just a little less than 2,000 residents and being given a land grant of 44,000 acres. I think probably the real difficulty would be the borough approaching the state and passing the red face test to ask for more land. The limit here, I think, in Petersburg is all about their economic development being self-sufficient. And if you look at the grants that most of the other municipalities have been given, it's been reasonably substantial piece of land. So I know that the Denali Borough was certainly aware of when the formation of the Wrangell and Haynes came about, but I don't remember any discussions of approaching the state to try and acquire more. Typically, when a borough does their selections, or at least my involvement was, we over-selected almost in hopes that maybe the state wouldn't notice and we'd get an additional 20,000 acres, but they stuck to their original acreage. But I think most of the organized boroughs actually have a substantial land grant now. I don't believe all of the selections have even been done with the larger municipalities. I think several of them still have land to select.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. With the sponsor in front of us, I guess I'll ask you this question. I think you're in office when the borough formation occurred. So what drove the borough's formation, the Petersburg formation, from the city of Petersburg to the city and borough of Petersburg?
Thank you, Representative Sadler, through the chair. Good question, and again, can defer to a more complete answer if I'm getting anything wrong to the folks from the Petersburg borough. It was a spirited civic discussion and deliberation in the Petersburg area. For the record, that elicited a chuckle from the back of the room, as I recall. And previously in Petersburg, there are sort of outlying areas on Mitkoff Island that were receiving various municipal services, but not part of the city of Petersburg, if I'm getting that right, and this was a way of sort of creating a more coherent whole in terms of being able to deliver local services. So I believe that included fire contributing to the Petersburg School District through the local contribution, and if I'm not mistaken, to some extent, road maintenance and plowing and the like. There may have been other motivations as well. I think the local boundary commission process was also engaging and complex, and there were interactions with the city and borough of Juneau as well in terms of local control and the jurisdiction that Petersburg would have versus the jurisdiction that Juneau would have. So I believe that was sort of an element of the process to some extent. So those are the two sort of major points that stick out in my memory from the debate, but just want to qualify, I might not have gotten that completely wrong, and the experts in the room behind me can correct me.
And if I may follow up?
Follow up?
And I think that kind of begs the question, but so kind of to get it on record that you believe the additional acreage would be sufficient to meet the goals to provide fire service and road service and educational services and so forth, that's the purpose for the request, and you think that it's sufficient?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, yeah, I think on a broader economic level, yes, in that I think a lot of municipalities and local governments in Alaska see the writing on the wall that state support is diminishing, certainly already has diminished to some extent, and that they're interested in sort of pivoting as much as possible towards self-sufficiency, to local economic development, and to whether it's supporting the school district or a greater cost share of running the local jail, that they want to sort of make ends meet and drive their local economies as much as possible. So I guess the more succinct answer to your question, as I understand it, is yes.
Yes, very good. And comment for the record, I don't know if state educational support has in fact been reduced in Petersburg.
Representative Sal, through the chair, good point, and I believe that's accurate.
Thank you. Unless there are any further questions for Representative Christ-Tompkins. Thank you. Is there any further discussion on the bill or any further questions for DNR in the person of Marty Parsons?
Through the chair, Mr. Parsons, just curious, has DNR ever considered changing the formula under which land is made available, like increasing the percentage of UU land to avoid these kind of circle backs to pick up some spare acres?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, it's in statute, so it wouldn't be for DNR to change that percentage. That would be up to the legislature to determine if they wanted to modify the percentage of VUU land that the boroughs were able to select from.
True, but the governor does request bills from time to time, so. Okay, fair enough.
Thank you again, Mr. Parsons.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If there is no further discussion, I would entertain a motion to move the bill from committee. It would be moving to finance, where it would have an additional hearing before its second reading on the floor. Representative Sadler.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair. I move that we pass House Bill 85, version LS0384A, from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
Object.
We have an objection.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, in my objection, I just wanted to clarify. Earlier we discussed the committee's policy regarding moving bills out after a single reading. You said that if a bill had been previously heard by a different committee, that might mitigate towards passing out a bill after just one hearing. My understanding is this is the first committee referral for this bill. Is that consistent with your policy, or on what basis do you want to move it out after one hearing?
The policy is clarified by my co-chair. It's going to be pretty case by case. In such cases as the bill only has one committee of referral, then I think it's very reasonable to hold it over for at least two hearings.
Okay.
In the event that it has additional committees of referral and there'll be additional occasion for public testimony, I see no reason to hold it over. Is your objection maintained?
I remove my objection.
Seeing no further objection, the bill is passed out of committee, and we'll take a brief at ease to collect individual recommendations. Committee will please return to order. Is there any unfinished business? Seeing none, we will adjourn the meeting at 9:47 a.m.